One of the biggest stressors in life is finances and economic stability. Financial stressors amongst immigrant families is often overlooked in a therapy context. For example, how often are we exploring the ways in which clients and their families are impacted when financial security is frequently in flux based on situations beyond their control? How do children in mixed status families navigate financial responsibilities? Furthermore, what are the pressures that the children and their families face? How do these experiences shape the way in which children of mixed status families form meanings associated with finances? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Sun. Today we have Dr. Ana Romero Morales. She goes by Dr. Ana, is a licensed pediatric psychologist and owner of Brewing Donato. Dr. Ana's clinical specialization is in infant and early childhood mental health, and her research focuses on mental health within the undocumented and mixed status community. She has a publication in the Journal of Latinx Psychology titled, The Impact of Undocumented Status on the Family, the Sibling Relationship, and the Self. As a Latina, first-generation immigrant, Dr. Ana will be discussing the role of considering financial stress and intersecting identities with immigration status. Dr. Ana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor.
Can you tell me, how did you get into this work? Share with me your journey.
Yes. So as you know, your intro mentioned, I am a first generation immigrant. So my parents were born in Mexico, and then I came as a young child. I was very, like many other families, I think my parents definitely emphasized the importance of college and higher education, even though they didn't know anything about it. And so I remember being in college and I had to write a capstone, and I was very curious about mental health and mixed status families, which is when family members comprise of different immigration statuses. So some can be undocumented, some are natural born citizens, others become naturalized, legal permanent residents. And I just remember thinking, like, I have a lot of personal connection and friends who are part of that community and wanted to learn more about it. And at that time, it was way back when there was barely any research on undocumented communities, on mixed status families, even less so. And so I started on trying to do lit reviews on this subject. I went to a master's program in Los Angeles because I wanted to be a community college counselor to help other first gen students get through the higher education pipeline. And again, I had a boss of mine ask if I wanted to participate in a panel and to discuss the subject I found interesting. So I did, again, another lit review on the most recent studies on mixed status families, especially looking at siblings. So when one sibling's undocumented and the other's a US citizen. And again, I couldn't find much though. I was kind of extracting from what existed at that point, and I got a lot of great feedback, and they told me you should really consider getting a PhD. And so I did. And so a lot of my research since then has been trying to make sense of the experiences of mixed status families. I think there's a lot in terms of the burden and the impact of parents when they're the ones who are undocumented and the impact it has on their children, but much less so about what it's like for the children.
Oh, right? Interesting.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Because now when you're talking about this, the parents are probably the ones who are seeking therapy, or the children are the one that's also getting treatment.
Yeah. So I was looking at it from a lens of, a lot of our research has focused on what's it like for US citizen children who have undocumented parents and the mental health implications. So when parents are, you know, working low paying jobs without a social security number, usually that means they might be in jobs that are exploitative, labor based. There's a lot of financial stress, right? The impact of worrying about deportation. And there's actually been studies where it shows, like, yes, many people think like the worst thing that can happen in a family system is that someone is deported, of course. But then there's all these other things that happen before then, right? Like the financial stress that happens, being unable to access resources. If you're injured, what does that happen to your family system when you can't work? And then, of course, if they're deported, the impact, not only emotionally, but also the financial impact of losing the breadwinner at times in the family system kind of trickles down to the children, who often are U.S. citizens who are able to access resources. But because they grew up in a mixed status family, at least in the research I did and interviewing participants, even U.S. citizens experience their life and live their life as if they're also undocumented. And so I think there needs to be more information and more research on the experiences, especially as they get older. Because when we work in mental health and we're talking to people who come from these families, even if they're the ones who are citizens and are not going to get deported and feel protected, they don't. Because, right, because if you tell your therapist, oh, I'm from a mixed status family, there's all these fears that come with it. Like, how does my identity as a citizen in the system is going to affect everyone else? How's it going to affect my siblings, my parents, that I'm sharing this information with someone, you know, potentially meeting for the first time in a session?
Yeah. And honestly, I would say most people wouldn't even know what do you mean by mixed status. Mm-hmm. And rarely do people consider, as you were highlighting, wait, children are oftentimes the one who are getting citizenship, whereas the parents are not. Mm-hmm. What are some of the reasons that might happen? Can you share with me some of the, maybe the, I don't know if it's immigration history or immigration process that we might want to understand to see how this plays out?
Yeah, so I think a lot of my research I did out of California, because that's where I grew up. And so there's a long, long history of immigration laws that have been in place that impacts most immigrant groups in various ways. The one I focused on was those coming from Mexico or who have Mexican heritage, who have this long history of this like push and pull factor of people get brought in to California to work in the fields, you know, but way back in like World War II, when people were in the army and serving and they needed workers. And then once things get better, people get pushed out. And so this push and pull factor is what has made it so that you have family who have been here for probably decades at this point, who have grown up here, who know this place as their life, their home. And then they have children here and those children are born here. And so it's an interesting mix of belonging but not belonging because of the current laws, right? Because the laws are constantly changing. So one moment you feel safe, the next moment, you know, presidents get sworn in and then laws are changed again. And so it's a constant state of limbo, is what they often say in research, this limbo place. And people who are citizens kind of get caught in it because that's your family system, right? You grow up living your life the way you think it's normal and the way your parents function. So in my research, when I was actually interviewing siblings together, it was very interesting to see the dynamic of even, you know, the undocumented sibling who longs to travel and have these experiences, and then the U.S. citizen sibling who can have all these things, and yet they're choosing not to because of their sibling, right? Because of guilt, because of, well, I don't want to experience these things without my sibling being there. So it was very interesting to see that, oh, as a U.S. citizen, you are also living life with restrictions, you know, out of camaraderie, out of guilt, or out of fear, right? You're missing out on like these life experiences with your family because of the limitations of your family status.
Wow. And when you were looking at the study, also maybe in the community, I would imagine that there, as you were highlighting, a lot of guilt if, let's say, the sibling is US citizen and they're unable to go out. I would also imagine the impact it has on the socialization process. I don't want to out my family. I don't want to out my sibling who is undocumented.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this interesting dichotomy because they don't want to because they want their family to be part of experiences, and yet they do take on that experience. So a lot of my sibling participants talked about being a bridge, right? Oh, you're the US citizen sibling. If there's a family, if there's a death in the family, if something happens, you have to go to Mexico and be the representative of the family because you are the only one to go. And so feeling this pressure and responsibility of, yes, I want to be there for my family and I want to support them in this way, you know, because they can't go there. So kind of taking on these different family expectations when status is thrown into the mix.
The participants, these siblings, that's navigating this type of responsibility. Mm-hmm. What age were these children?
So my youngest participant, and this was for my dissertation study, was 18, had just turned 18. And then I want to say that the older, I think, was like early 30s. You know, very interesting, right? When you're 18 versus when you've had time to process things differently as, you know, someone in their mid-20s and 30s. So it was very fruitful conversation to also hear about how these siblings have never spoken about this until I had that interview with them.
What?
Yeah.
So the siblings aren't communicating to each other. Wow.
Yeah. So it was very interesting. And there were moments where there was some tension as people were saying these things out loud. And right. Because very often, sometimes it's just very taboo. We don't talk about it. We don't want to think about it. It's a very painful thing sometimes. And at the same time, I think there was also really beautiful moments where people started talking about how this difference in status actually brought them closer, really influenced the career path. Like some of the people I spoke to, like, oh yeah, like I want to be a lawyer and work in you know, immigration law. And now I participate in student clubs that are focused on being allies to this community. So really seeing kind of the meaning they have made from their experiences as they get older.
And how did the financial stressor management come into the picture?
Yeah. And so that for me didn't come until after I graduated from my PhD program, which is interesting because throughout my education, I've always been stressed of like, how am I going to pay for school? I need to apply for grants. I need to apply for scholarships. I need to, you know, my parents were like, you should have been a doctor or an engineer or do something in business so that you could have a job that will provide you financial stability. But it wasn't until after graduate school that I moved to Colorado to do my internship, and I got a package from Fidelity with my investments. And I was like, oh, I have worked throughout graduate school and I don't ever remember hearing about grad students being able to have a retirement fund, and what exactly is this and what do I do with this now? I definitely felt like I'm in my 30s and I don't know. I know how to write a grant and a lit review and all of these things. I wrote a dissertation, but I have no idea how to manage my finances now that I'm outside of, you know, education. These were just conversations I would have with my husband because he is also first gen. And so we would talk about like, well, now we're married and how are we making decisions about our finances? Like, it's the pandemic. If our parents lose their jobs, how are we going to manage helping them on top of helping ourselves? And so I started Brewing Dinero as like a fun thing to do during the pandemic and create a platform to just start sharing what I was learning, because I reflected a lot and I'm like, I didn't have my first credit card till I was like 25, 26. I'm like, I felt so late in the game. And I don't know if that's, you know, growing up in a family where money wasn't talked about other than we don't have enough or we need to be careful how we spend our money and saving is important. And here I am trying to learn this now as someone outside of higher ed. And then it just started kind of having a momentum. I started meeting other people in the personal finance world. I got a scholarship to become an accredited financial counselor, which I'm in the middle of getting my hours for that. And learning that, oh, finances are not just numbers. It's also a lot of mental health, right? If we're anxious about our finances, we're going to manage our money in a certain way. If we have a lot of trauma about poverty or losing money, right? We're going to act or we're going to manage our money in a certain way, as even as an adult. And so I started kind of bridging the mental health knowledge that I had with the financial knowledge that I was starting to gain. And that's when I started looking at mixed status families. And I'm like, wait, yes, my dissertation didn't focus on finances. And yet there was a lot of conversations around money. Like I had siblings who talked about the college going process and, you know, one being like, you know, my sister is a citizen and she can access financial aid and she can access scholarships. So I'm trying to help her get there by sending her all these things that I could not have as an undocumented person. I had another participant who was much older than their US citizen sibling. And so she worked to pay for their sibling's education from a very young age. And so you see these finances and these stressors kind of weaved in throughout their narrative, right? Jobs was a big one. So I had a lot of siblings talk about, I'm the undocumented one. I wish I could work at McDonald's. Instead, I have to work under the table to be able to make some money versus my US citizen sibling can work anywhere. So even then there's, you know, both in a place from tension and in a place of like helping one another, finances were definitely woven into their experiences. And unfortunately, I think it's something I didn't learn in grad school. We never had a class on like financial psychology or how to help clients when they come to you. And maybe it's not the center point of why they're in therapy, but it might be lingering in the background.
Yeah, as you're talking about that, I'm also reflecting on some of my clients, especially the couples, where you have couples may have disagreement on the finances. And when you examine the ideas in a relationship, as you're talking about with finances, where did these constructs come from? And as you're mentioning, a learned process early on. For instance, some people approach from a scarcity mindset. I never had any finances, so I'm going to keep squirreling away. And also approaching work, I have to keep proving myself, keep doing this. I might lose my job. There's this fear aspect that's associated with the financial management piece.
Yeah, and I think especially for mixed status families or undocumented, you know, communities, it's also what they grew up either hearing from their parents or what they experienced in their own home country. So I've gone back to Mexico to visit family and be around my husband's family. And I've heard a lot of conversations about like, we don't trust banks here because you may not, money keeps disappearing from our bank accounts. And so I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like if you grew up in a country where the banking system was different or, you know, there was a time in your life where the economy wasn't doing well. And then you come into a different country like the US where you tell people like, don't leave your money at home. Like you want to have it safe in a bank. Like they're not going to trust that given their prior experiences. And so I think especially with families that are, you know, generational and especially mixed status families, that's something to keep in mind. Like it's great to offer advice, but you also have to know like there might be something in their decision-making that is influencing that, especially how intimidating it can be to like call a bank if English is not your first language. Or I know I've had this experience where I've called for clients of mine. I've called different banks to be like, I'm calling to see if I can open a bank account if I was undocumented. How does that process work? Half the time, the customer service people are like, we don't understand. What do you mean? What does that mean? I'm like, okay, well, what if they have DACA? They have a social security number and they can work. How can they open a bank account? And having to explain to the people, like, this is what DACA is, you know? Or sometimes on a lot of bank pages, they'll say, like, as long as you're a US resident, what does that mean? Like you're a legal permanent resident or you live in the US and so you're a resident. And so sometimes even a simple thing like opening a bank account gets very stressful for people who are undocumented or, you know, have DACA.
I mean, all the mental energy just to try to define legal status, residence, citizenship. Oh my gosh. I mean, that's more barriers, more reason for me to not open up a bank account if I had to go through all those hoops.
Especially if you want to get further into the finance, right? If you wanted, like, I remember calling Vanguard, which is an investment company, and asking them, like, okay, if I'm undocumented, how can I invest in your like open an investment account and start investing in the stock market? And right, having to, again, for my clients, like, imagine if they had to be the ones to call and disclose their status and go through this process. Like, yes, you probably wouldn't want to keep going.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about the Brewing Dinero. Is it a nonprofit organization, or is it, can you, what are the services? Share with me what you like our listeners to know.
Yeah, so Brewing Dinero has definitely, it's only been around for 2 years or so. It's supposed to be a platform where people can start their education process, where they can start learning about financial services that they have a right to access regardless of their immigration status. Since then, I have done workshops mostly online, you know, talking to high school students about scholarships and how you don't have to get into debt for school. Like, there is money out there, and trying to get that message out more, because there's a lot of myth around legal status and accessing money, especially in scholarships. And now I provide coaching programs. So I do a 6-month coaching program where I meet with clients every 2 weeks to work on their goals, whether it's I need to learn how to budget, or I need to start paying off my credit card debt, or my student loan payments are kicking in, or I want to know about investing and how I can do that. And also in that, we sort of work on this money mindset, like, okay, let's talk about your feelings about money. How do you spend? Why do you spend the way you spend? Because the goal is not just to, of course, learn all these financial skills, but also for it to, right, just like in traditional therapy, we want you to sustain those skills over time so that when you get into debt again in the future, you have the skills, but you also have this mindset where you won't spiral right into that stress that finances tend to get us into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the folks who are using the service, are they mostly organizations, schools that are hiring you that would seek you out?
Yeah. So the workshops have all been done at universities, because I am a big proponent that even when you're in college and maybe you're not working necessarily, it's good to hear this message early so that when the time comes, you have it. So I've partnered with universities for, you know, they pay me to come do the workshops and it's free for students. And many of my clients have sort of been first gen, you know, recent graduates, getting their first job, trying to figure that out. And also, surprisingly, I feel like now I'm having a wave of sort of that, like, millennial. The youngest have been like maybe like mid-20s all the way to about mid-30s, where now they're, yeah, so they're, there's either this, I think the new generation, because of social media and access to information, like the younger generation is like, oh yeah, I want to start investing. I'm like, wow, when I was in my mid-20s, I was barely opening a credit card to build my credit, and you're already starting so early. And then we have people who are like, I've been in school and now I'm finally out, and I'm also equally as lost. And I was like, yes, I know that feeling of like, oh my goodness, now I have to pay back this debt and I have my degree. And now I'm getting my first, you know, paid job and trying to get, you know, sometimes there's this feeling of like, oh my God, it's too late. I should have done this earlier. But it's hard if you don't know what you don't know at the time.
That makes sense. Totally makes sense. Now, for our therapists, faculty members, or professionals who work with clients who may experience immigration status or mixed status communities, is there a recommendation that you would offer them?
Yes, I think, and I appreciate this when I was in grad school, of like, you're not expected to be the expert on everything, right? And so I think one of the biggest things that you can do as, you know, a professional working with clients is building relationships with people outside of that field. Like, they're not only financial counselors out there, but there's also actually financial therapists who do therapy solely focused on that topic. And so building connections with professionals so that when you do come across a client who you realize, like, yes, there's a lot of other stuff, but finances are really causing a lot of stress, of connecting them with these people. Or there are a lot of organizations who provide financial workshops to help people be in a place where they're starting to feel a sense of control over their finances, and also recognizing like there's an entire systemic, you know, thing that's hard to change. But I have found that in working with my clients, like once they start feeling knowledgeable about their finances, what they can access, there is a sense of relief of like, okay, I feel in control. Like, yes, I still have a lot of debt. Yes, I'm still working through my budget, but I feel confident in managing these things, and it can truly make a difference, right? It might, just like anything, everything's intersecting, right? If I'm anxious about work and other things, but maybe now I'm getting a sense of my finances, that stress can might trickle down to other places. So, you know, building those connections and having that as a resource to give clients when you start noticing those things. Mm-hmm.
You're saying in many ways, developing these relationships with professionals who have certain areas of expertise and specialty you may not have, and to take that further and possibly even following up with these students or clients in the therapy session. How did that meeting go? Or just to support them in many ways, giving them the vocabulary, the space to feel empowered in managing those finances.
Yeah.
As a person of color, can you share with me a challenge that you have experienced that you would be willing to share? And this is also a challenge that you overcame.
Yes. I think one of the biggest challenges that I've had, you know, especially being first gen, I've had to navigate college, and then I've had to navigate high school because my parents, you know, my mom has a fifth grade education and my dad was able to do some high school back in Mexico. Has been to like always sort of learned how to navigate things and find answers for myself. And I think college was a very big stumbling block for me because I didn't know how to advocate for myself. I didn't know how to ask to be part of groups that would give me more resources. I sort of was always like, I'm just supposed to figure it out as a lone wolf. And I think by the time I got to grad school, I learned enough to kind of get through, but still sort of this struggle, like, my goodness, here's another system I need to figure out. But I think it's taught me a lot on how to help myself. And that's why it's really important for me now that I've figured out or navigated the financial system that I want to share it with other people, because I think it's really hard to do everything by yourself. And when you're also the oldest child, right, I'm navigating all these systems for myself, for my younger sister, for my cousins, right, for everyone in my system. And so I think that's why I think I'm very passionate about, you know, personal finance, is because it's not just about helping my client, you know, learn how to do all these things, but I know in our conversations, I'm like, you are also the caregiver of aging parents. You plan to have a family. You have a whole community that you're a part of, and you learning is going to trickle down to all of them. So I think that's been a challenge and also a blessing, and having to learn the hard way sometimes how to navigate our systems here, because it's very hard and it's very daunting.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. Having gone through such a challenging experience, spearheading for the first time, learning to navigate all these systems, and you see the value in also pulling your community, your family, also bringing them up.
Yes. My sister, the minute she turned 18, I was like, I am opening you a Roth account. You're working, you know, you're not making much money, but you are going to put away $5 a month into your retirement account so that I can start investing in compounding. And at first she was not happy with me about it because she wanted to spend her money on Starbucks or whatever it was at 18. And now she's 20 and her account has just like blossomed. Like, it's doing so well. And now she's like, oh, I've increased it to $25 a month. I'm like, wonderful. By the time you're my age, like, you probably have enough to not worry about retiring later in life.
Wow. I just want to echo this message of how important it is to have people of color as part of the psychology program, to see the relationship of how mental health is basically infused in many things we do. Like you said, there's what is it, psychology of finance, or what's the technical practice?
I think there's, you know, financial psychology, financial therapy.
Financial psychology, financial therapy. Yeah, yeah. And how can we support you?
You can support me by checking out my Instagram page. That's where I'm often at Brewing Dinero. Brewing because I survived off coffee in grad school. And so coffee, brewing, and dinero means money in Spanish. Go on there, you know, support me by sharing my posts, liking them, letting other people in your community know, like, hey, we can really use the financial system in a way that it can empower you. It's a tool, because, you know, we shouldn't have to work until we're 65 unless we want to, right? Like, we should be able to manage our money in a way so that it benefits us and helps our communities continue to, you know, thrive.
All right, Dr. Ana, well, thank you so much for your message. Do you have any other final thoughts?
No, thank you so much. And I'm really excited to start seeing financial therapy start making its movement, that more, you know, more people in the mental health field are starting to be like, oh, there's all these other topics and arenas that we can really start making a difference.
Well, Dr. Ana, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I hope you liked this episode. Please subscribe and share. We love to hear from you, so send me a message on LinkedIn or email. The People of Color in Psychology is brought to you by the Multicultural Counseling Institute, and I'm your host, Jack Tseng.